House Special Committee on Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism to order. And today we have Representative Higgins and myself, Representative Hughes, present. Several other members are in a meeting, other committee meetings at the same time, so more may join us. I'd like to thank Kathleen and Debbie for helping us out, and also my staff, Ginger. And we're going to hear today from Tyson Fix and Alexa. Is it Tonkovich from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. And so without further ado, we'll ask them to come up to the table and give us an update. We heard from them last year, so it'll be interesting to see what all's been going on in the last year.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Tyson Fick, the Communications Director of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. And I'm here with Alexa, like you say. I'm just going to talk very, very briefly on a couple of things covering the Alaska seafood industry, a little bit of basic what the economics look like right now, our ASME budget, a little bit of our programs. I have a video to show if you'd like to see it. Otherwise, I can direct you to a link. It's on YouTube. We were asked so often to give overviews of what ASME is up to that we went through the route of taking a lot of the footage that we have and making that information available online and for assorted presentations and things like that.
How long is the video?
It is 13 minutes, start to finish.
Do you have interest in seeing that, Representative Higgins, or?
What do we have, two presentations today?
No, we just have the one.
Oh, just the one? Oh, we'll sit them.
Okay.
I'm game.
Just a couple minutes on some current opportunities and challenges, and then Ms. Tonkovich will take over and with a little more of a deep dive on international markets, in particular China.
I am a little, if you know, as we go along, we can ask questions, right?
Absolutely.
And maybe I'm ahead of you already. Through the chair.
Yes, please, Representative Higgins.
62,650 workers in Alaska, 28,000 are Alaska residents. So a little over half of the seafood industry is out-of-state residents, out-of-state workers?
Through the chair, that is our most recent numbers. It kind of varies depending, and if you break that out and look individually between harvesting, the harvesting sector, the fishermen, is more percentage of Alaska residents than the processing sector is weighted more towards out-of-state.
Okay.
Thank you, and I have a follow-up to that. Of the 35-plus thousand that are not residents, how many of those are from out, not U.S. citizens?
That I would have to get back to you with that information. I don't have that.
Is it like a third or quarter?
Maybe you have a better guess.
Okay, thank you, Representative Higgins.
And you know, another follow-up to that. You know, I guess what I would like, if we could, and maybe it'd be hard to put it in a graph form, of I know those are seasonal workers. What season is that? Where the majority of them are at? And how long are they in the state or wherever they're processing, so that we have a feel for what we're talking about here? I mean, I don't know if there's a way you can get that data to us.
That is. I believe a lot of this data can be found in this report that we commissioned this year from the McDowell Group that talks about the economic value of Alaska seafood. It has very in-depth employment numbers and economic input for Alaska as well as the United States, and tracks add-on jobs and those sorts of things.
Okay.
So I think you probably have a lot of what you're looking for right there already prepared.
We'll read through the report.
We'll take a look and make sure and follow up with you to make sure you have what you need.
All right, thank you.
Good.
And actually, I would like, thank you for this book. I'm not sure when I'll have time to read it. You know what would be really helpful? Could you do maybe one-page highlights of things from this report that might be good? And maybe you're going to cover some of them, and they're in the presentation. But I was also wondering, with all those that are coming from out of state, the economic input they have into our state, what do they spend while they're here, and that kind of thing. And I'm guessing that kind of information is in here, so if you'd be willing to highlight some important things that would be good for us to know.
Yes,
about
we can pull
that
some
population.
Of that up and prepare a little white paper for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we covered a lot of this, but suffice it to say the seafood industry touches just about everybody in Alaska, whether you realize it or not. One thing that comes to mind in particular is backhaul freight fees. Because of all the frozen seafood leaving Alaska, I've heard from freight companies that expenses would be as much as 10% on every item that shipped the other direction to Alaska. It would be that much more expensive because they actually have a backhaul and there's something to export from the state.
For the record, Representative Herron has joined us. Welcome, Representative Herron.
We're the top seafood producer in the U.S. by a wide margin, more than three times the next largest producer, roughly 54% in the last year. We have good data for, but if you take that into a global perspective, it's less than 2% of the global volume. I guess 57 was the most recent number, sorry. I was a year behind. This is what our composition by volume of the seafood harvest is, but you'll see it's a much different picture when you look at it by value. Salmon, although 12% of the volume, is 29% of the value, and crab jumps from 1% to 16% of the value, things like that. And that's where we find that we get our funding from at ASME is a 0.5% tax at X vessel. So the way to increase value of the industry is to get the maximum value for every fish that we take out of the ocean.
And Tyson, may I interrupt? I'm still pondering the prior slide about how we compare to the rest of the United States. It made me think about where we are as far as the world market. What percentage is that, and has that grown at all, and is there potential for more growth there? And maybe you're going to talk about that.
Yeah,
we'll talk.
Okay, we can wait on that then.
Yeah.
Here's what the X vessel value has done. The bars are total value, and the red line is price per pound, generally positive trend, certainly over the last 10, 12, 15 years. This slide, I think, tells a really great story. This is the historic salmon harvest in Alaska, and we've had a commercial salmon fishery since about 1880s. And this goes back to 1900. And the two orange arrows are two really important dates in history. One is statehood, when sustainability and sustained yield principle was written into the state constitution. And then if you look at 1974 to 1976, you have the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And that put control of U.S. waters and fisheries management from 3 to 200 miles offshore, effectively kicking out foreign fleets and pirate fishing. You can see what happened to the salmon, what happened after that. You know, you go between statehood to the middle 70s, it's bumping along between 25 to 50 million fish harvested every year. And then last year we set a record with 272 million fish harvested in Alaska during the salmon season. The first time it was over 1 billion pounds of salmon. And this is a breakdown of last year's numbers. This is preliminary. There's the way it works is with retro payments and whatnot, you don't really settle on a final number till pretty much you're starting to fish for the next year. But you can see a large portion of the volume was pink salmon, and then pinks and sockeyes were the largest two sectors for value. And this is what's happened with the salmon X vessel price at the same time. Over the last 10 years, it's more than tripled in value at the same time as the world salmon supply, that's the black bars, has increased. So even in the face of increasing supply, our own salmon value has increased substantially over those years.
Representative Higgins.
You know, and just to go back a slide or two, you know, as my brain is formulating this, you know, we've got over a billion pounds of salmon that we've harvested last year, and I'm not a commercial fisherman. All right, I'm just a sports fisherman, I guess. You know. And yet we have rivers that are having a hard time with salmon take. And as a sports guy, we always look at the commercial guys and go, oh, you guys are harvesting way too much. You know, I mean, you're not giving a chance for our fish to come up our rivers and spawn. I mean, is that, I guess on the surface, that's what I'm looking at. And that may not be true at all, but as a sportsman, that's what we look at. And I don't know if you have any data on that to say that, no, actually, this 1 billion pounds is well within reason. There's plenty of fish coming in. I don't know.
That would be a better question, I think, for the Department of Fish and Game, who sets the escapement goals and manages for that escapement. What our job is, in a lot of ways, is to tell the story of how that happens. And it's really an impressive story, what happened at statehood. And then throughout that, the commitment to time and area closures, limited entry, so many things that got pioneered in the commercial fishery for salmon in Alaska are now looked on around the world as, well, that's really how you ought to be doing it. Now, there are some real challenges, you know, certainly with Chinook salmon in, you know, large swaths of the state. And through that, and with some great work, where a combination of effort between the Department of Fish and Game and commercial fisheries, there's some really good examples on the Yukon, for instance, where you have a very large summer chum run coming. At the same time, you have distressed king salmon runs. Well, it doesn't do the king salmon any favors to over-escape the chums and further compete in freshwater habitat. And at the same time, you don't want to take out a whole bunch of kings while you are targeting a summer chum fishery. So they developed things like a dip net fishery for the first time this year. And a couple of years ago, started a fish wheel fishery in Caltag, where the kings can be released unharmed, but at the same time you can have access to that excess biomass for the large returns of chums.
Right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heron.
Thank you. But Tyson, I think what Representative Higgins is getting at, and don't get me wrong, I'm a commercial fisherman, a sports fisherman, and I live on the cusp of equipment that's distressed. The kings are distressed. But see, what I believe the representative is noting the irony is where we do promote the sustainability, that battle that you're constantly fighting, and then but at this, in this slide, you're bragging how much we harvest, and that's where the irony. Now this is an internal report to essentially an internal report to the legislature, but you don't brag on how much we get, you brag on how we manage sustainability. That's the irony he's talking about.
And I'll follow up with that. The Board of Fisheries adopted some things just this last week regarding Cook Inlet fisheries that are affecting up in the Susitna River drainage area. And looking at that slide, wondering what part of the states where all that is harvested, and whether you're hearing any concerns about the proposals that were just adopted, and how that will we expect any of that to impact these numbers for 2014?
I don't know enough about those proposals to say one way or the other, and that would be, again, the work at Fish and Game to maintain our sustainable harvest status, right? And then we have compiled some of the numbers, and we thought it was a truly remarkable situation that, 40 years after the Magnuson-Stevens Act was passed, that there are, by and large, more fish in our waters than there were previously.
And as follow-up, do you have anything that's showing where this volume is being fished? I mean, is it mostly off of the coast of western Alaska, or, you know, is it evenly spread around the coast, or where the bulk of it is being fished, particularly the pink and sockeye, just because that makes up the bulk of it, you know?
About 65% or so of the sockeyes harvested in Alaska are from Bristol Bay. The rest are kind of a mix of locations. From Chignik out in the Aleutians, there's some in Cook Inlet is a pretty major fishery for sockeyes. and throughout the southeast. The pinks are primarily southeast and Prince William Sound.
Okay.
And then the rest around the state, certainly.
Okay, thank you.
I can supply more information, more fine information on where the salmon were harvested specifically, if that would go.
Okay.
Like that.
Any other question about that before he goes back to the slide or comment? And I do have a question about the slide where the demand has gone up, but the price has also, which is kind of an unusual thing. Why do you think that is?
Great marketing, largely. And that it's an interesting story with salmon that the best analogy I heard was farmed salmon is a lot like jugged wine, where you go back 30 years and not a lot of people drank wine, but Gallo introduced jug wine to the masses, and now there's all sorts of small wineries and people that are turned on to these great little wines. Well, salmon was a similar story. When we were the largest supplier, there was a very small market to shoot for. And then farmed salmon introduced a bunch of people to the concept of salmon generically, and then we had the opportunity to turn them on to the best salmon in the world. And we build the Alaska brand. That's a great brand to have, and we have great stories to tell. We're, again, the second most commonly specified brand on U.S. menus, ahead of Oreo cookies, but behind Angus beef. Here's some more information from our most recent surveys. How likely are you to recommend the following to a friend, family member, or colleague? Alaska seafood comes up first, Alaska salmon second, and then all of the other proteins down the list. We try to coordinate as much as possible with other
people who are carrying... Was that survey, were those Alaska consumers or U.S.
consumers?
U.S. consumers.
Huh. Try to coordinate our marketing efforts as much as possible with... places like Alaska Grown and the tourism marketing, and then other individual companies that are also in charge of the Alaska brand, as it were. And oysters is a particularly interesting story because they're farmed, so it's Alaska Grown, but it's seafood, so we get asked about them a lot, so we would include them in things like our shellfish buyer's guide and whatnot.
The most important piece of this EpiPod is an amazing ingredient. Something worthy of the world's finest restaurants. It will take all of your culinary skills, brain, and brawn to cook with this most incredible, this most beautiful, the freshest king salmon. These beauties are caught while trolling off the coast of Alaska. Undoubtedly, the greatest salmon in the world. These fish in front of you cost over $500 a piece.
Wow. You need to break down one of these amazing salmon each and then make seven perfect salmon dishes using those fillets.
So that little clip is from a show called Master Chef, which was on primetime on Fox. And the reason why I brought that up specifically was the same production crew that we worked with in the tourism group to do Top Chef here in Alaska a couple of years ago. But we maintain those contacts, so when they are doing a challenge and want to use fine seafood products, I get a call and help facilitate this and put the fish on there with our messaging, and this went out to millions of households, and we could never... ever in the world afford this kind of advertising. It would have cost us in the tens of millions.
Are those really $500 a piece, each of those?
And worth every penny, Madam Chairman. I guess if you take into account that they were winter troll caught kings that were air freighted to a studio in L.A., by the time you do shipping and 20-some dollar a pound for those fish, it's getting pretty close. It might be a little bit of a stretch, but...
Yeah, I was just concerned a viewer watching that might think, oh, that's out of my range. I can't fix salmon. That would be my concern. But
Madam Chair, is that if you go to a quote-unquote fine restaurant, Mm-hmm. You know, your plate will cost $25 anyway. So mm-hmm. you take a 30-pound king and multiply that. That's where they get their number.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Just kind of a comment on that.
Higgins.
I was at a restaurant earlier, you know, in the year, fine restaurant, and salmon. I asked, where's your salmon at? And, well, it's farm salmon. Don't know where. And I said, well, I don't want it. They go, what? Why don't you want it? I said, well, I eat fresh salmon. So I said, oh, you must be from Alaska. And I said, I am, actually. So,
I'm sure.
Good for you.
On that point is I was had the great opportunity to go to the European Expo in Brussels, and we went to this catering outfit that serves from weddings to kings and queens of countries, and asked them what's their number one request in seafood, and it was scallops. And I says, where does salmon come in? He says, it's not on the menu, because in Europe especially, farm salmon is pedestrian. And so if you want an inexpensive meal, it's like we go and we want to make a quick meal using Hamburger Helper. We get ground beef. They just buy fillets of farm salmon. And so it's never requested for special events. But they didn't know this outfit. They didn't know that Alaska is famous for wild salmon. But in Europe, it's again, it's pedestrian.
Looks like we'll let Alexa speak to that later. Maybe there's some more work that we need to do in Europe. Thank you. Continue with Tyson.
Just a couple of the individual opportunities and challenges, and there are far more than this. In social media, I would certainly call an opportunity and a challenge. And there's misinformation with Fukushima and IUU, which is illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. And it's not that it's happening within our waters. It's other countries that are in competitive markets, crab in particular, over-harvesting their own stated quotas, which then crashes the market. And the most recent estimates was about a 25% lower dock price for our king crab fishermen because of oversaturation by particularly Russian fleets.
The certification, could you sum up what the challenge is in that one? Just review that for us.
The sustainability certifications. I will cover that shortly. I have one particular slide on Walmart, and we can work on that there. Working with Keegan Randall, Alaska Olympic skier. She's just a really great GIT activist and a very good representative for us. We're in all sorts of social media platforms. We have a photo contest going on right now. Voting is open for another few days till the 17th to help select a fan favorite for a photo contest we have. And through that, we've got another 3,000 fans. We're just right at 80,000 as of this morning. Fukushima radiation is certainly something, and information, mostly misinformation, is something that we have been dealing with on a regular basis lately. And part of that is that we are a conduit for good information from the independent and state and national and international groups who are doing actual testing and providing good information on the grounds to combat just real bombastic misinformation. In Walmart. The announcement last week, I guess it was 2 weeks ago now, that Walmart would accept Alaska's Responsible Fisheries Management certification and would continue to source Alaska salmon was very good news for everyone involved and a long time coming. And ASME and the seafood industry very much appreciates the support of everyone in government, our national delegation, the governor himself, the legislature. It really made a big difference in that that dialogue. So sustainability certifications were found
it's hard because I could go on for hours about how this this whole thing came about. But basically, about 10 years ago, sustainability as a marketing tool was latched onto primarily by NGO groups, WWF in particular, that started a certification label called the Marine Stewardship Council Sustainability Certification. Alaska salmon was the third fishery to be certified under that, and the first of any kind of size. It was Thames River herring, rock lobster in Australia, and then all of a sudden Alaska salmon really put it on the map. Flash forward a number of years, and as that certification got used by more and more fisheries, there started to be a situation where you had to have a certification to go to market. You didn't necessarily get a premium price at the market, but just allowed access to the marketplace was kind of a basic bar to get over, that you had to have a certification. About four years ago now, the board, ASME board, directed staff to look at alternative certifications that would meet their customers' needs, but would also not pass along the high cost of logo licensing fees and would not give up the state's sovereignty in things like fisheries management. Because there were three primary concerns with the growing and expanding eco label situation: was a brand devaluation for Alaska, intrusion into fisheries management, and market access. So this was in a direct interest to address those three challenges, and now we see it being accepted in markets throughout the world, really. And Alexa could cover that maybe a little bit more on some things in particular. It is more important in places like Germany, less so in Asia and most of the United States, because there's a wide agreement that we should be fishing sustainably, but there's very little agreement on exactly what that means.
With Walmart's announcement, do you feel pretty secure that there won't be other major grocers that will cause a problem in the U.S. anyway?
Madam Chairman, yes, we are very hopeful that that is the situation, and I think that we are seeing a lot of positive work on that front.
But Madam Chair, we have to, I mean, of course, ASME has to be careful in the fish world and the seafood world about politics, but to have great partners with Senator Murkowski, Senator Begich, Don Young in our federal delegation, because the federal government was going to stop buying our food because we didn't have this London-based logo master. We didn't take their demands. And so when our congressional delegation convinced the federal government that you do not listen to other NGOs that are based in London about what's best for federal purchases, that was a really big winner for us. And so our congressional delegation has to be thanked for that.
I would say, very much second that, Representative Herring.
Thank you. Continue.
And we had a whole bunch of pinks. So we have expanded our efforts in that pink salmon marketing. It's particularly in cans. That's certainly presents a very nice challenge to have when the harvest was so high. But the challenge for us really is to maintain the value, not just to dump product on the market and crash the market for future years. And there was a $20 million U.S. food aid purchase of canned pink salmon that will be going into the global food aid supply, which is really a good, a very good start, and that's really the only protein in that, animal protein in that market. And thank you, and I will turn
before you.
Alexa, unless you have any questions.
I do, and if you want to pass it off to Alexa. I caught the tail end of a lunch and learn that Vince O'Shea was giving, and I kind of asked it was somewhat rhetorical, but it still intrigued me because he was talking about the increased use of automation in the processing and just understanding economics and the cost of labor and how, you know, our labor costs are higher here than in other parts of the world, that automation and the increasing the productivity can helps us compete. Technology helps us compete. And I was thinking how popular sushi is right now. It's just, you know, the younger generation particularly. And thinking about the small amount of fish that's in a sushi roll, and wondering if there has been any kind of equipment or anything that would make something like that possible, where we could do that value-added processing and market sushi, and maybe it has to be made fresh right before it's served, but is there any consideration that something like that, or we could do more value-added processing having to do with the product? Because we ship not just, and I know we're doing more frozen fillets now than we were doing canned, but any other added processing that is being looked at, or that there's potential and anybody moving towards where we could, aren't just shipping out the raw product?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of interest in value-added products. In particular, the waste stream is something that's of acute interest in the processing sector right now, and that's everything that's not the fillets. The frames, the heads, so you're looking at things like fish oils and fish meal, even the pet food market, and some of this is driven by wastewater rules that are coming down the pipe, but also in the macro sense, all throughout seafood, the seafood world, 100% utilization is something that everybody is kind of striving for. And these are, you know, it's a great opportunity to take things that previously were waste and derive value from it. Protein powders, like I say, fish meal, things like that. And that's happening all over the state currently. As far as value added, like for people breading, frying, things like that, there is certainly an interest, and we're hearing a lot that people would like to see more of that happen in the state, in the U.S. There's certainly some challenges with logistics, how widespread and remote the state is, how fast the runs come in. Most of the salmon fishing really happens in about 3 weeks in the summer, so it's all you can do to get as many in the freezer and in a can as possible, and then think about what you're going to be doing with it after that. And energy, you know, the economic development throughout the state, a lot of times it comes back to energy and whether it's worth keeping a large plant open longer in the season in a place with a very high cost operating environment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. You ready for Alexa?
Alexa Tonkovich, ASME International Program Director. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and to the committee for inviting me to speak today. I oversee ASME's international program, which covers 21 countries throughout the world in Europe, Asia, and South America. Today, I'm briefly going to touch on the China market and some of our activities there. And if you have questions about other markets, I can try to fill those in as well. Today, I'll cover Alaska seafood exports generally, our exports to China. I'll discuss China as a reprocessing center for Alaska seafood, give a brief economic and market overview, and then discuss ASME's efforts in China, including our target markets, some highlights of our activities, and some future trends.
Alexa, that logo on the previous slide, does that say natural, wild?
It's wild, natural, sustainable, as close to it as we could get in Chinese.
Thank you.
Okay, so Alaska seafood exports generally. As Tyson mentioned, in 2012, Alaska produced 5.4 billion pounds of seafood. We make up 57% of the U.S. commercial harvest. Looking at the percentage that is exported, of that, 64% goes to export. if you looked at Alaska as though we were a country, which some of us think we are, Alaska would be the sixth largest seafood exporter behind Norway, Russia, Vietnam, Chile, and Canada. Looking at Alaska's seafood export markets, I want to highlight this for a couple of reasons. It's a little bit misleading. You'll see that China is our number one export market for Alaska seafood. However, several of the countries on this slide are generally or have traditionally been reprocessing centers. So China, Korea, Thailand, Vietnam, even Central Europe all have a processing component. If you look at an end user of Alaska seafood, Japan is most likely still our largest market, which it has been for about 20 years. But China is catching up. Looking just at Alaska seafood exports to China, the most current full year data we have is for 2012, and we expect that 2013 data will be fairly similar for China. It was roughly, 2012 was roughly stagnant from 2011, where we saw a huge jump. But if you look at it over the past 5 years, the value of Alaska seafood to China has nearly doubled in a five-year period. Again, to go back to China as a reprocessing center, traditionally China has been one of the major reprocessors of Alaska seafood. Looking at exports, total exports of frozen fillets out of China, which would be product going into China, being reprocessed, and then being exported to other countries. The breakdown of that is roughly a third going to Europe, close to a third coming back to the U.S., and then about 17% going to Japan. Again, traditionally, China we think of in our industry as a reprocessing center. However, due to the increasing cost of doing business in China, both because of the strengthening of their currency and increasing wages in that market, we're actually seeing the reprocessing sector shift out of China. We're finding it's shifting to other countries, Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia to some degree. But as reprocessing shifts, we have actually seen a very strong increase in domestic demand in China, which has replaced a lot of the volume that was previously designated for reprocessing and re-export. If you speak with processors and people in the seafood industry in China, they're shifting their focus. They used to cater to their customers in Europe and the U.S., and they're now shifting their focus to the China market and marketing their product to Chinese consumers. And this has really happened in the past, I'd say, 5 years, pretty dramatically. So why would China be a good customer? Just a brief economic overview. I've seen a couple different GDP estimates, but basically we're looking at over a 7% year-on-year increase in GDP and an expectation that GDP will grow about 7% a year for the next 5 years. The U.S. is China's second largest trading partner, their third largest export market, and the number one source of imports. China is currently a $250 billion market for U.S. companies. Looking down at a lower level in the market, we see high levels of consumer confidence in China. This is witnessed by a growth in retail sales of about 14% year on year, a little higher even in the urban areas. We see dynamic growth in the food service sector and a demand for imported products. Unfortunately, for domestically produced products in China, there have been a number of food safety scandals in recent years, almost too many to keep track of. Every couple of months, a new food product makes the headlines because of food safety issues. And because of this, this has really tested Chinese people's trust in their domestically produced products. The flip side of this is, of course, it increases the demand for imported products. And that includes a demand for imported seafood. The domestic seafood produced in China not only doesn't match their demand, but it's viewed as unsustainable or as not as high a quality as sometimes imported seafood is viewed. We also see increasing per capita seafood consumption in China. FAO did a report recently working with the Chinese Ministry of Agriculture. And seafood prices in China are expected to rise up to 70% between now and 2013, between 2013 and 2050. This is part due to shortage of supply, growth in demand, and wage growth. So looking more specifically at ASME's efforts in China, our office was established in China in 1997. We have two wonderful reps there. They're headquartered in Shanghai, and their company has offices in Beijing, Guangzhou, and Hong Kong. Our China program has always focused on building demand in the domestic market. We do provide trade servicing support to processors there, but we've always been trying to build the Alaska brand in China for domestic Chinese consumers. We have a number of different strategies by which we build this awareness. One, creating awareness of Alaska seafood attributes, of the variety of Alaska seafood. You know, if you talk to a chef in China, probably most of them have heard of Alaska king crab. But we want to let them know we have Pacific cod, we have black cod, we have all different species of salmon, we have yellowfin sole, we have roe, really expand their awareness. We focus a lot on new-to-market products. Chef and trade are always looking for new products to advertise to their consumers to have the latest, greatest thing. So if we can bring in pollock roe, which traditionally only went to Japan and highlighted as this new product, it generates a lot of buzz. We provide education. A lot of the seafood traditionally consumed in China was fresh and whole fish. So to see our, you know, frozen packaged fillets is a little different. So we work a lot on educating chefs, consumers, anyone really, about storing, handling, and preparing Alaska seafood. We try to build their comfort level in working with frozen product, in preparing Alaska seafood at home. And a lot of this is done through recipe development and developing recipes that will work in that market.
So, excuse me, are you providing things like this in Chinese then?
Similar. We can't actually use that one, but we have pretty similar types of materials. A lot of our program is for consumers is focused on recipe development and publishing those recipes. Since China is a huge market, and although our budget is generous, we can't reach all the consumers in China, so we have to drill down to some target markets. We initially targeted first-tier cities when we started our program, which would be Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou. We then moved out to the surrounding areas of those cities and eventually moved into some second-tier cities, particularly coastal ones that are more seafood-oriented consumers. In the consumer sector, we target younger consumers, housewives, and higher-income consumers. On the trade side, we work with importers and distributors who are supplying hotels and restaurants, as well as large chain retailers. And on the food service side, we target chefs and purchasing managers from mid-range to upscale hotel groups and restaurants, as well as a few select fast food chains. Just an overview of our activities, we target consumers, trade, and hotel restaurants with our activities. We do PR, sponsoring events, press campaigns, we place advertisements, we use social media, we go to trade shows, we conduct trade seminars, retail promotions in stores, trade PR through seminars and through newsletters, hotel and restaurant promotions, chef seminars, chef competitions, and a culinary school training program. I have quite a few activities in here, and I don't know how short we are on time, so I'll go through them fairly quickly. We send out ideas for articles to press, try to get recipes published. We sponsor activities. We particularly work with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who also matches our funding. We occasionally get to do TV shows. Like Tyson said, TV time is expensive, but when we can reach a broad audience and directly educate them on using Alaska seafood at home, that's always fantastic. In lieu of TV, we place billboards once a year in major cities. We like to place them in places like bus stops and train stations where you have a captive audience, 5 minutes waiting for the bus, 5 minutes to learn about Alaska seafood. We have a trade and consumer website, and although Facebook is not allowed in China, they have something similar called Weibo, and we do have a blog on Weibo. We do brick-and-mortar, in-store promotions, Alaska signage, in-store demonstrators, tasting. We recently had a pretty exciting promotion that I did want to highlight, because this is something a little different for us. We worked with Tmall.com, which is Asia's largest online retailer. They have 500 million registered users and 40 million daily unique visitors. During October and November, Tmall featured an Alaska seafood shop on their website, and they gave us actually front homepage space. This was a 9-day promotional campaign that culminated on November 11th, which is more or less China's equivalent of Cyber Monday.
Representative Drummond has joined us. Welcome, Representative
Thank you,
Drummond,
Chair.
For the record.
It's hard this time of year. We have so many conflicting committee meetings. Yeah, they'll be over soon.
So again, November 11th in China is sort of the equivalent of Cyber Monday. And so we did a 9-day campaign with Tmall leading up to that day. A total of more than 33,000 orders for Alaska seafood were placed during the 9-day period, selling 50 tons during that 9 days, approximately $1 million of seafood, and then another 8 tons sold just on November 11th. The nice thing about this promotion, I think, is not just the sales figures, but we had Alaska videos, we had Alaska signage, Alaska photography. And if you think about 40 million daily unique visitors, even if they're not buying Alaska seafood, they're probably clicking on our video, and that's advertising that we could never pay for. Trade shows, we have 3 different trade shows in China that target the food service, the retail, and the importer-exporter sector that we have booths at and encourage industry to participate with us. We hold a number of trade seminars in major first and second tier cities, attracting importers, retailers, wholesalers, and distributors to provide them with information about Alaska seafood and ASME's activities in the market. We, whenever possible, like to bring buyers and press to Alaska. Showing off Alaska is probably the best part of this job. Last summer, we brought a group through Seattle for some one-on-one meetings and then to Juneau and Petersburg to meet with fishermen, to take them fishing, to do plant tours, toured the hatchery in Juneau. Since August, we've generated $150,000 in sales from this mission, and we expect that these relationships will go on for years to come, hopefully, and increase that number. We work with international hotel chains as well as some locally targeted hotels and restaurants and a few casual dining fast food restaurants to conduct Alaska seafood promotions in restaurants. We've found that chef competitions are a great way to build enthusiasm among chefs. We work with China's Culinary Association, and we'll usually select 1 or 2 Alaska seafood ingredients to highlight, and a number of different chefs will have to design their own recipes using that Alaska seafood product. It's also another great way that we generate recipes that we can use in our consumer program. And finally, we work with China's leading culinary schools to educate the next generation of chefs. We find that if we catch these chefs early in their career, educate them about Alaska seafood and how to use it, they become ambassadors for our brand when they move on to, you know, 4-star restaurants or hotels.
Great.
And that is all I have. If there's anything, any questions or anything else you'd like me to address, I'm happy to.
Well, actually, Representative Higgins, go ahead.
And you may not get involved in this, in these issues or not, but in China, do you guys, like the geoduck issue, where they banned on that, do you advocate, lobby for them to lift that ban? What's your work on that?
We don't specifically lobby. We have been monitoring that situation, and DEC within the state of Alaska has done a really good job of monitoring that, and we try to stay in touch with both DEC and the U.S. Department of Commerce, NOAA, National Marine Fisheries, which would be more the body that would be advocating. I know that they have petitioned to the Chinese customs officials to lift that ban, and they have been doing some testing. Canada, interestingly, does not have a ban against their gooey duck. It seems to just be the U.S. We have found, I'm to say this diplomatically, I guess we have found almost every year since I've been working with ASME that there is a product that seems to get red flagged by China. And sometimes I believe that it maybe relates to some other things that are going on in their climate. But we seem to always be able to work through it, and I'm confident that they will be able to this time as well. It just sometimes takes a lot of work on behalf of our USDC delegation.
Okay.
Slide 4, I think it is. I'm looking at a PDF, but I had asked earlier when Tyson was speaking our share of the world market, and if I were really, really good at math, I could add those up, and then I would know what percentage 3.2 is out of the total. But so, what is our share as far as the world market? Or you can get back with us if you don't know what that is.
I'd have to get back for sure, because there's a lot of other smaller players that aren't listed in this,
okay.
The top. in terms of value, it's a larger value number than volume. There's a lot of low value volume forage fish, things like that, that put our volume number at, even though we're 54% of 57% of U.S. seafood, we're less than 2% of the global supply. What the value number is, I'd have to get back.
So 2% volume, but a higher percent value.
Yes.
And room for growth with the volume.
Madam Chairman, that's the thing with wild fisheries, is that it's all biological in terms of value, volume. There are some underutilized species, certainly some rockfish, herring. A lot of herring gets left in the water because there's not a market for it currently. Sculpin, cabazon, things like that that wouldn't be traditional markets that we would think of, that would be the place to get at volume. But in terms of large numbers, that's really pretty small comparatively.
Okay. I want to wrap up here. I do have a question that probably should have been asked at the very beginning, but I think it's just important. So, because you did go over this last year, but could you just briefly tell us about the organization of ASME itself as far as its governance, its funding, mission, just in a nutshell?
Absolutely. That's what I had the video for, but we seem to be running a little long, so I pushed that to the end just in case we wanted to watch it now. ASME was formed in 1981. We're a public-private partnership with the state of Alaska and the Alaska seafood industry. We're funded from three sources, a voluntary 0.5% tax taken at X vessel, and that fluctuates between about $8 to $12 million, depending on the value of the current year's harvest. $7.8 million of general funds and $4.5 million of federal funds in the Market Access Program through the USDA that funds international marketing or portion of it. And we match that with GF and industry contribution. We have a 7-member board of directors. That's 5 processors and 2 fishermen. Four are the large processors, and that's the largest processors in the state, the Trident, Ocean Beauty, Icicle, and Peter Pan. And then the small processor, Quick Pack, Jack Schulteis from Emonic, and the two salmon are both salmon fishermen, one from Bristol Bay and one from Southeast Saner. In addition to that, we have a very robust group of just dedicated industry leaders who are on our committees, and they're both based by species as well as by operation. Alexa just came back from an international marketing committee meeting in Seattle where you can make the plan for the next year, and that's some of the people from some of the companies we mentioned and more that give us input on what are the challenges, where are the opportunities, what specific things about whitefish do we need to know about, or shellfish, or whatever it is that then helped us direct the marketing efforts within the organization. So that kind of very close coordination with the industry has been tremendously valuable to help coordinate our efforts and then with them, because, you know, we don't supply any fish. We supply talk about fish and printing about fish and videos about fish. They actually have the product, and so we have to stay in very close contact to know what their customers are asking for in an accurate way.
I'm assuming your primary mission is marketing, since that's in your name. Is there anything else about your mission that was important for us to know?
The most important thing about our mission is to increase the value of Alaska seafood resource. We're out there working every day, and it's an amazing effort that goes on in this organization. I'm always impressed with everybody I get to work with, that we're doing a heck of a job of making fish as expensive as possible. So when you go to the store and you see that $25 a pound halibut, I say, you're welcome. Isn't that great? Isn't that great? And thank you from the halibut fishermen out there who get to appreciate their work. And when we go and we can tell that story in so many different ways, and when you see 30-foot waves crashing over the side of a boat, and you don't get a lot of people complaining about the expensive crab legs that they're eating at that time.
Yes, and thank you. You are obviously doing a good job. The impressive slide where you showed the worldwide supply going up, but yet the value increasing, and so you've been doing your jobs. Are there any other questions before we adjourn? Okay, I just want to mention that on next Tuesday we're going to hear from Dr. Wisniewski with the University of Alaska Fairbanks on their programs involving entrepreneurs, patents, and inventions, and the Alaska Seawolf Fund the University Seawolf Fund that is associated with that. And then Thursday, we're going to dip back into the Arctic conversation and hear from John Higginbotham from Ottawa, California, or Calgary. Oh, my Ginger's not here. So, and the Marine Exchange of Alaska, and we'll be talking about those northern shipping routes in relation to the Arctic and potential for Alaska. So, with that, I believe that we are finished. Thank you for joining us, and we will adjourn at 12:00.